This episode is sponsored by Amazon Handmade. Amazon Handmade is the destination to find unique handcrafted products created by artisans and makers from around the world. With categories like home and kitchen, jewelry, baby, beauty, stationery, and even pet supplies, you'll be sure to find something you love, all while supporting small businesses. Plus, handmade items make for incredible gifts. Check out my gift guide for this holiday season at amazon.com/handmade holiday. Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the pod, I'm speaking with the co-founder and CEO of Blueland, Sarah Paiji Yu. The company is creating biodegradable and thoughtfully designed products, including refillable kits for non-toxic household cleaners, soaps, and laundry detergent. To date, Blueland has raised over $3 million and has saved more than 500 million plastic cleaning bottles from ending up in our landfills and oceans. At the helm of such an innovative company, it's not surprising that Blueland isn't Sarah's first go-around. In fact, she spent years building brands, but in quite a different industry, specifically fashion and retail. Sarah's first company was the mobile shopping platform Snapette, which she sold to Price Grabber just 2 years after launch in 2013. She was then a founding partner at the startup studio Launch, which created a slew of incredible brands, including the children's clothing brand Rockets of Awesome. There's no doubt that Sarah knows how to found and lead brilliant businesses, and I can't wait for you to hear how she continues to push her career and industries forward. Now, on Second Life, it's Sarah Paiji Yu. So let's take it back to the beginning. What did you study in school, Sarah? And what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Yeah, so I majored in economics at Harvard for undergrad. And that was definitely not the path that I thought I was going to take growing up. Yeah. Growing up, actually, like pretty much my entire life, I always thought I was going to be a pediatrician. You know, I grew up to immigrant Asian parents who really wanted me to be a doctor. I love children. You know, at a young age, I thought like, oh, yeah, doctors, that's how I'm going to help, you know, the people around me and make my contribution to the world. And so I actually started at Harvard pre-med, but ended up shifting to economics at the beginning of my junior year.
What made you interested in economics?
Yeah, so, I mean, when I got to Harvard, I was, you know, so excited about all the different areas and things that I could learn and immerse myself in there that I just didn't want to spend, you know, half or more of my coursework, honestly, in the sciences, and thought that, you know, economics could really help me bridge and explore a lot more of my interests than being a science major.
So after Harvard, you went to work at McKinsey as a business analyst. I've spoken to a handful of other people on this podcast who worked there in the beginning of their careers, including Jen Wong of Reddit most recently. And I'm always curious about what that experience is like for someone who is just coming straight out of school. What were your responsibilities? And more importantly, what was the learning curve like?
Yeah, so I mean, I still look back so fondly at my time at McKinsey. I truly don't think I could have asked for a better first job out of undergrad. Because at that point, I still had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I was intrigued by the business world generally, because it felt like, you know, that left a lot of doors open and left, you know, a lot of opportunities to wear a lot of different hats. But I didn't really know what that meant. And so McKinsey seemed like an ideal place to me to just be able to explore, you know, take on projects in a wide range of industries as well as functions. And I think most importantly for me, it really taught me how to deal with ambiguity. And
Tell me about that.
Yeah. Because I mean, the crazy thing about McKinsey is like you're being thrown into these projects in these industries and functions that you have no experience at all, right? Like my first project was in the residential mortgage derivatives market.
What did you know about that?
Exactly. I knew zero about that. All of a sudden, you are expected to, you know, be in these meetings with very senior executives. And even at the most junior level, even as an analyst right out of undergrad, you're expected to manage client teams on every engagement. And so, you know, you definitely have this pressure to quickly become very knowledgeable and an expert in an area that you have no prior experience, and also help solve problems that, you know, are completely new to you and are difficult problems for even the people at the companies that you're trying to help. Yeah, I think it's a really important skill set that, you know, I've taken with me.
Well, I love talking about skill sets and the things that we learn early in our career that we move forward. So you were at McKinsey for a little under 2 years and became the youngest tenure analyst to begin leading projects as an engagement manager in the history of the New York office. How did you move up so fast?
From my perspective, you know, after about a year in, I felt like I had learned a lot of what I had wanted to learn as an analyst. I, you know, was looking for four more challenges. I was looking for management experience, and I vocalized that. At the same time, I was getting reached out to by financial for investment firms and hedge funds about, you know, opportunities elsewhere. And I was, you know, talking about that pretty openly with my mentors inside the firm. And it, you know, kind of manifested itself in them encouraging me to try to create these, you know, manager opportunities. And, you know, I was able to find an associate partner who was willing to take me on early as an engagement manager, which means that I would be managing a day-to-day team.
I mean, that's very sexy as someone who is just out of school to be leading a team. That's really cool.
It's cool, but it definitely was, you know, at that point in time, it's funny because I was like 23 at the time. And I remember having people on my team, like these associates were in their 30s, right? And they were married with children. And I just, like, I definitely felt that age gap. And I definitely was self-conscious about the fact that I was managing these people that seemed, you know, quote unquote, so much older and mature and further just in their life, and, you know, even had kids, you know, gasp. So it was interesting, but also a good exercise also in confidence building in my own abilities.
Yeah, I would imagine. So you left and moved to the private equity world. Can you tell me a little bit about what your thinking was, why you decided to take another job?
Yeah, so my thinking at that point was that, you know, after my 2 years at McKinsey, I had learned a ton. I loved my experience, but it was pretty clear to me that I wasn't interested personally in becoming like a career consultant. I ultimately wanted more agency in the work that I was doing, to the extent that, you know, at a consulting firm, you are, you know, making recommendations at the end of the day. And, you know, at that point, they can decide what they want to do with that, and they can decide if and how they want to execute that. And I think for me, I realized that piece of it was, you know, unfulfilling, that I did want to be able to, I believe so strongly in some of the things that I was working on that I thought it would be really exciting to be able to then implement and really drive that change that I had so much conviction around. And so I was intrigued by private equity, which is, you know, within finance, it's where you invest in private companies instead of public companies. But unlike venture capital, you're investing in more mature companies that have typically been around for a while, you know, typically for us, you know, are doing a couple $100 million in revenue. And what I was intrigued by with private equity is that private equity firms actually owned the businesses that were in their portfolio. You know, you invest, they would invest into these companies. They would typically take a majority ownership position. And the goal was then to improve operations and ultimately, you know, exit those businesses for a profit. So I really liked this notion of, you know, you had the ownership and the agency to be able to not just come up with the ideas, but also implement them, and then really then reap the benefits of that change that you drove.
So you stayed in private equity for a couple of years, and then you decided to go back to Harvard, but this time to get your MBA. I'm always curious about the calculus that goes into this decision of disrupting your career that is so far going swimmingly to go back to school. And I'm curious as to whether you would recommend it to others who are considering taking a similar path.
Yeah. So for me, it was, you know, it was a very personal decision. You know, I went into that decision like eyes wide open that, at least for me, I didn't see a ton of value in like the curriculum or even like the degree per se. But for me, I know, and this is why I don't recommend it for everybody. I really, really don't. But for me, I wanted to take a break. I wanted to be able to step back. I wanted to be able to really figure out what it was that I wanted to do with the rest of my life. You know, private equity, I went in, it sounded like it was going to be great, ultimately ended up being, you know, less so working with the portfolio companies on the operational side and more so just pure investing, right? Which was valuable for a whole host of reasons. I became an excellent like financial modeler and all these things that have, you know, helped me in many other ways in my, you know, startup pursuits that were to come. But, you know, at that point, I just realized, okay, you know, I'm not a lifer either on the investment mm-hmm. side or private equity. It just didn't do it for me. But then it was like, but then what, right? And I think I just recognize it's also really hard to, you know, maintain a job, especially like a fast paced, high pressure job while trying to like figure out what you want to do with your life. And business school seemed like a good place to go where, you know, you'd be surrounded by peers that have worked in a range of different industries. You know, you get a chance to have an internship, you know, all of that. And I think that all seemed appealing to me, because at that point I really did want to, you know, figure out what it was that I want to do next and hopefully, you know, get a lot closer to figuring out what it was that I want to spend the rest of my life doing.
Well, it seems like that didn't take very long, considering the fact that as a first year business student in 2010, you also founded your first business, SnapApp, which was a mobile platform for local fashion shopping. So can you please explain your idea for the business and what the landscape of shopping was like at the time? I have my own personal memories of 2010,
yes,
but
yes.
I'd love to hear it from your point of view.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And like, by the way, who starts a business in their first year of business school? That's crazy.
I know. It's funny because I was like, oh, I'm going to take a break. It's going to be great. And yeah. I was like, I get there and literally like 2 months in, I'm like, I'm starting a business. I thought I was going to go to business school and pretty much figure out what industry I wanted to be in and like what function that I would like climb the corporate ladder until I was, you know, 60 plus. Like that was the plan. And when I got to business school, I was just incredibly inspired by the women that had come before me also out of Harvard, right? Like Rent the Runway had just launched, Gilt Group, Bauble Bar, Learn Vest, Katrina from Stitch Fix was a year ahead of me. And I think that's like for the first time, like I realized like, oh, wow, like, you know, these women have a very similar background to myself, right? A very similar, you know, stage in their life, and they're just going out and doing it. And I just found that to be incredibly exciting and inspiring. And like for the first time in my life, because I've always been like, prior to that, I'd always been risk averse. I mean, I, you know, had built a career that was, you know, very much so about like checking all like the boxes of what felt like the right job moves or the school moves. And I just realized like, oh, business school is such an opportunity right now. Again, I have kind of that safety net, or I have that permission to do kind of almost anything while I'm here and still kind of get credit that I was, worst case, like in business school, that I decided like, now's the time. Like I should try to do a startup now in business school.
I love how much you're hedging your bets.
I know. I'm transparent. I feel like
I
you
love
have the
that,
entrepreneurs
though.
That are like, yeah, I was an entrepreneur since I was like 2, like selling candy to my friends. I'm like, that was not me. So to be honest, I was more dead set on becoming an entrepreneur at that point than inspired by an idea that took me to entrepreneurship, if I were to be completely candid. But at the same time, I was excited though. Like that, when I got to business school, had finally got an iPhone, and I was like, wow, like this is going to change everything. And, you know, people are walking around with these powerful computing devices. You know, Mary Meeker at that point was like saying, everyone's going to spend, you know, more time on their phones and computers. And people were thinking like, that's crazy, but maybe. And the app ecosystem was starting to get buzzy. You know, people were talking more about social. This was like right before Instagram launched, but there was still a lot of interest in like Facebook and Twitter. And so like social, local, mobile was kind of like all the rage. And yeah, the idea that I had for Snapchat was that, you know, shopping online had become, you know, a lot easier over sort of the past, you know, 5 years leading up to that point. You know, if you're looking for like a white dress for the weekend, you can go on Google, find all these options in your size and, you know, check out and you're done. But, you know, local shopping was still very difficult. Like if you're out in, you can be standing in the middle of Soho, undoubtedly there's going to be tons of options around you in your size at your price point, but it's like impossible to do that local product search. And so that was the, you know, quote unquote big idea that I had, that, you know, we would work with brands and retailers to make that local inventory and discovery readily available to our app users right on their phones.
So what were those early days like? What were the biggest hurdles? And at what point did you start to build a team? Because I feel like that's always sort of a crucial tipping point.
So many hurdles early days of Snapchat. The biggest one for us was probably, you know, ultimately, you know, we had a chicken or egg problem, to the extent that, you know, the vision was to make all of this great local product inventory available to our app users. To get that local product inventory information, we would need to partner with brands and retailers who had that information at a local level and would be willing to share that with us. But as you can imagine, you know, the brands and retailers would not be interested in doing that work, much less paying us so that we could be a business at some point, unless we had app users. And the app users, you know, until we had local product inventory information, had no reason to use our app because our app would provide no value. And so, you know, the earliest days was really trying to figure out how do we deliver value to potential users so we can, you know, build up a robust base, a user base, so that we can then go to, you know, retailers and brands and convince them that they should work with us. And so what we ended up doing, and this is pre-Instagram days, so there was like, I recognize that, you know, there were a subset of women that really enjoyed talking about their bags and their shoes and taking pictures of them and sharing that with their community. And there was something, it's probably still around, called Purse Forum. Do you remember Purse Forum?
Oh gosh, yes, I sure do.
Yes, that's what inspired the first iteration of Snapchat, that, you know, we would create an app that was photo-based, where people could easily take photos of bags and shoes that they own or had recently purchased or recently seen somewhere that they really loved. You know, they tag it to a location where they purchased it, and that would be sort of the location-based functionality. It was all, you know, user-generated to start, and that's how we were able to, you know, initially develop a pretty like valuable initial user base that then enabled us to get a handful of really great boutiques on board who just at that point in time weren't looking to invest in their own full-fledged websites, but were looking to make it easier for even their best customers to be able to check in to see what was new in store, you know, what was available in their size, you know, communicate with a sales associate, etc. And, you know, once we had, you know, a robust number of boutiques and some great names on, that's how we were able to start getting bigger brands and retailers on. And ultimately, you know, we brought on Nordstrom, Saks, Gap, Ann Taylor, Nine West. Yeah, exactly. But it definitely was, it was a slog for sure.
So let's fast forward a little bit to 2013. 3 years in, Snapchat was acquired by Price Grabber. I would love for you to walk us through what an acquisition really looks like from the inside, and also what it was like for you personally as a first-time co-founder and CEO.
Yes. So, you know, we were very fortunate to be able to have an acquisition just 3 years in. You know, the industry dynamics certainly really helped us over the next 3 years. the predictions of internet usage shifting to mobile, like in a dramatic way, ended up coming into fruition. And so, you know, PriceGrabber was one of the leading shopping search engines, actually was the leading shopping search engine at the time. Google had not yet entered the shopping search space. And so you had a lot of these other websites, if you were trying to do like comparison price shopping, that you would go to search. And so PriceGrabber was an example of that. And they reached out to us unprompted. And, you know, that triggered something in me. You know, for me, in the founder seat as the CEO, despite the fact that I was always out selling to investors, to obviously attract users, to potential brand partners, it became increasingly clear to me that it was going to be that the economics of that idea for Snapchat just didn't work. And it was going to be a very difficult business to scale. And when that offer came in, we needed to be considering raising another round of capital because, you know, the initial $2 million that we raised was starting to run out. And at that point, when we got that first email in, I decided to drum up a process. But the challenge was, at our size at that point in time, we weren't really big enough to engage a banker. Like, there's no banker that would be interested in like helping us sell our company. But the good news has been that I spent 2 summers at Goldman Sachs in investment banking, and then I was, you know, in private equity, which gave me some of that transactional experience as well. And so ended up just running that acquisition process.
DIY sale. I love it.
I know, but it's like, I know how to put together a deck and I know how to put together, you know, three statement financial model. And I know what you mean by cap table. So I can do this. And, you know, it's a really nerve wracking process, especially because for us and for many companies, when they make this decision that they're going to go down the acquisition, you know, path, you know, at that point, it doesn't make sense to raise any more money. But, you know, these acquisition conversations can take a long time. I think that, you know, that process end to end took probably about 8 months. And in that process, you know, you're turning over all of your financials. And so the party on the other side also realizes that at some point, like, you have no option, right? So you kind of start losing negotiating leverage as well. And so that was tricky. And, you know, for us, honestly, this is a story that I don't really talk much about, but we ended up running out of money before the acquisition closed. And so, you know, even leading up to that, the series of difficult conversations with our team, because I wanted to make sure that, you know, I was being completely transparent with our, you know, about 15% team at the time as to exactly what was going on. Because at this point, you're dealing with other people's lives. You know, it wasn't fair to not give them visibility. So starting from, I think, when we had about 3 months of cash left, was pretty much telling people, I suggest you leave. We're going to keep going. I think we'll get this deal done. If we get this deal done, you know, I will do everything in my power to make sure that you are compensated for this time, right? And I'm pretty confident I can do that. But that said, I don't, you know, want you taking this risk with me. So I do encourage you to start looking for other things. And, you know, I was very lucky that the team decided to all stay on.
Wow.
Very lucky in the sense that, you know, when someone's also trying to acquire you, it's people is a big piece of it. Had a meaningful number of the people folks left, it would have been hard to get the deal done. But it all worked out. We got the deal done. We were able to institute the back pay. Everyone was made whole. Ultimately, it was a win-win, but it was extremely stressful.
I'm like getting a tense back just hearing this. So you stayed on for another year and then decided to do something new. And that something new was becoming a partner at Launch, which is a startup studio that operates direct-to-consumer brands. Walk us through what that really means. Was Launch both an investor and an incubator? Tell me about your whole thought process and becoming a partner. I want to know it all.
Launch, I pretty much joined at the ground floor. You know, I knew the founders of Launch. They were the founders of Rue La La, which was one of the first flash sale sites. Yes. Oh. They reached out asking if I was interested in doing this with them. And they, you know, shared the idea. And I, you know, agreed completely with this belief that, you know, at that point in time, I think this is 2013, that we were still in very early innings of direct-to-consumer. Like, at that point, like, Warby Parker was, like, the example.
Yep.
And really, like, the only example. And the hypothesis is that we would continue to see other industries like tampons and razors and toothbrushes and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, like, move direct-to-consumer. And that, you know, with launch, we could create a back-end or a more scalable platform to launch DTC brands in different verticals. But and unlike a venture capital model, instead of spreading the capital widely and not being very involved, we would make very concentrated bets and effectively be the founders of these businesses. And so the goal was to launch one business per year.
So one thing I think is interesting is you didn't just launch new companies. You also were the CMO of two of the brands during that time, correct?
Yes, yes, correct. So for the first two brands that we launched, MGemmy and Rockets of Awesome, I was the founding CMO for about a year each. And then with Full Lane, I stepped in as a GM or general manager, kind of president type role.
Got it. Okay, so not to fast forward again, but we have to because your career is so interesting and we haven't even gotten to the big switch, which is in 2018, you left Launch and launched another brand of your own, which is your current company, Blueland. Please explain the concept for any listeners who may not be familiar because it's really brilliant.
Oh, thank you. So Blueland's mission is to eliminate single-use plastic packaging, and we are starting with cleaning products. We sell our products as a refillable system. And so, for example, the first set of products that we launched were a set of cleaning sprays and liquid hand soap. But what's different about our products is that, you know, they come with a set of beautiful, durable, reusable bottles that you can simply refill using our tablets. And our tablets are about the size of a quarter. They come packaged in paper instead of plastic. And how it works is you simply fill one of our bottles with warm to hot water. You drop a tablet in, starts bubbling or effervescing all on its own. And after a few minutes, you have a full bottle of cleaning solution or hand soap. So yeah, the hope is that you don't have to keep buying and throwing away these single-use plastic bottles. You know, also as a consumer, it just makes no sense, especially with those product categories. Like, these products are, you know, oftentimes over 90% water, which you already have at home.
Sure
and
do.
So, yep. So no need to pay for water. You can just use the water you have at home. And, you know, you can conveniently also stash a bunch of refills in your drawer. So yeah, those were the first set of products that we launched about a year and a half ago. And since then, we've also launched our dish soap products, as well as a dishwasher tablet, as well as laundry tablets, which is what we've launched most recently.
All of this is very pandemic friendly. I just like to point out, not only is it non-toxic and efficacious, but it also doesn't take up a lot of space, which is wonderful. Okay, so talk to me about the R&D for this. I can imagine it would be a very long and arduous process. So what has that process been like?
Yes, long and arduous are good ways to describe what our journey's been. I would also say, had I known it was going to be as hard as it ended up being, it was good that I didn't know.
Otherwise, I feel like that's just being an entrepreneur, though. Like, if you knew what you were getting yourself into, you probably wouldn't do it, but that's the whole point.
yeah, exactly. But, you know, in the beginning, we're like, yeah, we're going to create these dry tablets. Like, they don't need to be liquid. We'll make them dry so we can package them in paper. And we had the naysayers early on being like, but why hasn't it been done then? How come none of the big guys are doing it? Like, is this even possible? And, you know, we did learn, you know, very quickly on that many industry insiders and manufacturers just simply didn't believe it was possible. I think we had about 40 different manufacturers, cleaning products manufacturers, tell us no.
Whoa.
That's scary. Yeah. Then they would explain to us, like, most of our ingredients come to us as liquid. And so what is this hocus pocus you're going to do to turn these liquids into solids? You know, we don't even own tableting machinery. You're going to have to go to, like, a candy factory
to get something like that done. Everyone was pretty much telling us, like, we can't help you with this. And so at that point, obviously, I have a wonderful co-founder who I actually went to business school with. So neither of us were chemists. So we weren't going to be the ones to formulate it. So we ended up, you know, just turning to LinkedIn. You know,
you found your chemist on LinkedIn?
We found our chemist on LinkedIn.
That's amazing.
But, you know, after a lot of, like, kissing a lot of frogs, like, we still have our spreadsheet of, like, over 100 different chemists that we found on LinkedIn. And, but, you know, the chemist, our head of R&D that we ended up bringing on was truly, like, the unicorn, because we needed someone that not only was an excellent cleaning products formulator with deep cleaning products experience, but we also needed someone that had experience formulating dry products. So our head of R&D, Syed, he was the director of formulation at Method, which is one of the largest non-toxic cleaning brands in the world. And even prior to that, had spent, you know, many, you know, years across various cleaning brands. And prior to all that, though, he was formulating nutritional supplements and probiotics, so like vitamins. And so he had that dry format, dry tablet experience.
I mean, this is just fascinating. So let's talk about money. Can you walk us through your fundraising process? Because you've raised over $3 million to date in various rounds, but I'm curious about the various stages that you've gone through. And if you want to talk about Shark Tank, I would be very interested to hear that story as well.
You know, initially we did bootstrap. We bootstrapped for about a year, but then, you know, the R&D costs and the manufacturing costs to really get started and put the finishing touches on the product were meaningful. And so we ended up having to raise money before having a product, which is extremely difficult. It's become increasingly difficult over the years. And understandably, I think, you know, investors want to see some degree of traction. And in our case, you know, some degree of, you know, proof that what we say we're going to create, we can actually create. You know, we had prototypes, but they were not, were certainly not final. And, but, you know, had no choice, you know, went out to the market. I think, you know, my co-founder and I are both serial entrepreneurs. And I think that really helped us in our ability to raise money. And the fact that, you know, through launch as well, you know, I'd raised a ton of capital through those businesses and had really good relationships. So it was easy to get the initial conversations started, but, you know, and you'll hear this a lot with funding rounds, it was hard to get the round going because a lot of people were, you know, quote unquote interested, but not willing to, you know, quite have the conviction and be the first to pull the trigger. And so, you know, that was also like a longish process.
Tell me about Shark Tank.
Shark Tank was one of the craziest things I've ever been through. You know, having been at this point like an entrepreneur for the past 10 years, it's always been like a half joke, half real dream of mine to go on Shark Tank. And now I do feel like after Shark Tank, I can really just do anything.
Anything,
because you're in there filming for, like, we filmed for over an hour. They don't stop the cameras for anything. And you just have like these five judges like coming at you. And what I didn't realize from watching Shark Tank is how much like they interrupt each other and how much they interrupt you, like how disorienting it can be. I mean, so many crazy stories. Like, I guess the other thing that was really tough for us is that we went in asking for $270,000 for 2%, but knew that we were only willing to give up max 3%. Mm-hmm. And so the room at which I had to dance and negotiate was like, incredibly small. Exactly. And I was like, oh my God, they're going to like laugh us out of the room or like, you know, rip our faces off when I go 2 and they're going to go like 30% and then I'll go 3%.
And that's all you have to negotiate with.
And that's all we have to negotiate with. But we ended up making it work because Kevin was one of the sharks that was interested. We got offers from 3 sharks. He was one of the ones that was interested. And I just remember thinking like, oh, the royalty is really important to him. And so ended up throwing in a small royalty that was capped at the 270. And he took it. And so, I mean, to our shock, we got a deal done.
That's incredible. That's so incredible. So obviously the pandemic has affected every industry in one way or another or multiple ways. And I'd imagine that Blueland could actually be experiencing an uptick in revenue as everyone has become so incredibly mindful of cleaning. But I could also see on the other side concerns about natural cleaning products. I feel like this is the only time that people probably are interested in toxic cleaning products. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about how it's affected your business and how you've adapted in any ways.
I think, you know, those two assumptions were spot on. Like on one hand, we did all of a sudden see the surge in interest in cleaning, which was shocking to us because we actually chose to start with cleaning products because it was like a low interest category. Like, cause no one cared. Like, people just did not care. They didn't think too hard about their purchases and they didn't care too much about, like, there wasn't a ton of like brand loyalty.
Right.
We started with cleaning for those reasons. And all of a sudden, like, people became really interested in and intense about washing their hands and wiping down their surfaces. And so, you know, despite what you'd also think in terms of people who are looking for disinfecting products, which they were actually, we saw demand spike like overnight to like 300, three times more than what we were doing prior. It was crazy. And part of what was also driving that was that, one, people were afraid to go into physical stores to buy the conventional products. And if you did go into a physical store, all the conventional products were sold out. I think Clorox wipes are still sold out.
Sure are.
Yeah. So, you know, that definitely was, you know, a great opportunity for us as well, because we had a ton of people that all of a sudden were interested in buying our products who otherwise, you know, would not have environmental intentions or otherwise would not have been looking closely at our products. And so in so many ways, it was really and it continues to be a really great opportunity for us to spread our message and really just reaffirm for people that, you know, our products do work. You know, efficacy has been super important to us from the beginning, which is also what took so long. You know, we test our products in independent third-party labs. We test our products alongside the major brands. And, you know, we share all those test results up on our blog.
Amazing. Okay, so let's talk about mistakes, because everyone makes them and no one ever wants to be candid about it. So I'm hoping that you can tell me about a mistake that you've made in your own career and what you've learned from it.
Yeah. The biggest mistake that I would say I've made in my time in startups, and I've made it several times, which is why with Blueland, I've been so dead set on not making it again, is not focusing enough upfront on product market fit. It's easy when you're an entrepreneur to, you know, obviously you have a lot of passion for what it is that you're going to create. It's easy to like convince yourself that, you know, there are many other people out there who are like you and would want this product that you're creating. And it can be easy to skip the step of confirming that that is actually the case. And really thinking about, like, is this exactly the product people want? Is this the price point at which they want it? It's easy to skip that piece of it and have your own intuition or gut lead that, and then jump into thinking that the problem that you need to solve is marketing. And it, when you do that, you're spending, you know, precious time and marketing dollars effectively filling what may be a leaky bucket, because you're trying to push or sell a product that may not be as attractive as it could be for a variety of reasons. And it's just so much more efficient to really like nail, like, for example, the pricing of your product. Like for us, for example, like there's so many different levers, right? Like do we sell our bottles with a tablet? Do we sell our products in kits, right? Do we price our tablets at $1, $2, $3? Like any one of those decisions can really meaningfully impact the trajectory of your business. So it's really worth spending that time up front in answering those bigger questions before you're sending free samples of stuff to Instagram influencers or running Facebook ads, et cetera.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are interested in switching lanes in their career, but are a little bit nervous about it. I'm hoping you could give us some advice for anyone who is scared to make that leap but really wants to do something new.
Yeah, my advice would be that if you're certain that you want to make that switch and you want to do something new, I would say go for it. I mean, I don't think that, you know, there's ever a perfect time or really a perfect opportunity, but, you know, think about how far you can be if you just start to make that switch today.
I love that. And my last question is, if you could go back in time and speak with younger Sarah at any point in her career and give yourself some work advice, some career advice, what would you say?
Yeah, so my advice to younger Sarah would be to chill out, that it's okay to not have a 5-year or a 10-year or a lifelong career roadmap, and that it is so hard to be able to connect the dots forward and predict, you know, how your experiences may evolve and how you may evolve as a person. Because I think even what's, you know, really important and exciting to you right now may change, you know, as you get older and go through these life changes. You know, certainly becoming a mother was a huge, you know, life change for me personally. And so, you know, focus less so on the destination and figuring out what the destination is, and more so on questions like, are you happy? Are you learning? Are you growing? Are you working with people that challenge you and make you better every day? And I think if the answers to those questions are yes, then you're doing great.
I love that. Sarah, we're done. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
That was Blue Land co-founder and CEO, Sarah Paiji Yu. For more inspiring interviews with women like Sarah, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, so please tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life. Thank you to Amazon Handmade for sponsoring today's episode. Amazon Handmade empowers makers with the tools necessary to showcase their products to millions of Amazon customers. In categories like home and kitchen, beauty, toys and games, and so much more, each Amazon Handmade product is crafted by a talented maker. Shop today to find a gift for yourself or someone else, and check out my curated gift guide at amazon.com/handmadeholiday.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.